This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Manuel Oxenrider. Hi, it's nice having you on.
Hi, thank you.
So we'll be discussing mostly the situation in the Ukraine. So you recently traveled and stayed in Crimea. When was that?
Yes, I was in Crimea during the time of the referendum. I arrived there around 1 week before the referendum. The referendum took place at March 16, and when the day I landed on Crimea, Crimea actually declared itself as an independent state. So technically, I was never visiting Ukraine this year. And I was staying until the day after the referendum. I was doing interviews, reportage, visiting a lot of interesting places on Crimea. And of course, I observed the referendum itself, but not as an official observer. I have to say this because there are already wrong claims around the web. But as a journalist, of course, I observed the referendum.
And I guess what I'll ask you is, what is the opinion of most of the people in Crimea about it? Do they support joining Russia, or do they view it as an invasion or occupation?
the general opinion fits perfectly to the result of the referendum. I have to remember the referendum, I think, ended with 96-97% pro-Russian, and this was exactly what I experienced or what I witnessed during the interviews before. When we see Western mainstream media, we see two general wrong claims, by the way, about the situation in Crimea. Claim number one is that there was a Russian military invasion and that the referendum took place under Russian guns and with Russian threat. This was claim number one. Claim number two was that all the parts of the population which are not Russian-speaking, for example, the Ukrainian-speaking part of the population as well as the Tatar population, would, as a collective, not vote pro-Russian. These were the two wrong claims. So to claim number one, I can say there was no Russian invasion. It was hard to find any Russian soldier. Of course, there were Russian soldiers on Crimea, but these soldiers were there since a long time because they are part of the naval base, the Black Sea Fleet of Russia, which is located in Sevastopol. So these are the normal Russian soldiers there. There was no invasion. You didn't see the Russian tanks. We saw, for example, on Fox News in US, these tanks were not on Crimea. These tanks were participating at a maneuver somewhere inside Russia. So this was a wrong claim. There was no Russian occupation, there was no Russian invasion, and of course there was no Russian aggression on Crimea. And on the other side, when you were speaking to the population on Crimea, how they would elect or how they would vote during the referendum, it was very interesting because, for example, the Tatar population said very clear that they are maybe not the closest friends of Russia and of Moscow, but they didn't see the choice between Ukraine or Russia. What they saw was actually a putsch government in Kiev, a government built as a mix of oligarchs, of criminal oligarchs and hooligans, doing decisive steps against social security. For example, the rents, the retirement money was reduced while the energy costs rise. So the normal people were hit very hard. Maybe this is the first effect of the so-called free market on Ukraine. So they saw this, and they saw on the other side the social security and also the physical security delivered by Russia. So they had not the choice between Russia and Ukraine, they had the choice between security and chaos. And of course, they voted for security. And this as well is also for other minorities or other ethnic parts of the Crimean population. So this was very interesting. So the general opinion I witnessed fits perfect to the result of the referendum.
And what is the opinion of ethnic Ukrainians who are non-Russian living in Crimea? Did you get a chance to talk to them?
Of course, it was very interesting because you were seeing these people. Sometimes they were standing in long rows in front of the bank house of the Ukraine oligarch Kolomoisky, who has a bank house chain in Ukraine. And it was very easy to talk to these people. They were taking off all their money because they wanted to bring it to Russian banks. Reason was very easy. They knew what happened in Russia during the Yeltsin times when the oligarchs were taking economical and also political power in the country, that no savings were secure anymore. And for the Ukrainians, it was the same philosophy, what I told you for the Crim Tatars. They had the choice between security and chaos. And of course, everybody would vote for security instead of chaos. So we have the very dedicated pro-Russian voters who were, of course, the Russian speakers of Crimea who were running around with flags, who were celebrating, who had we had a lot of stages we saw where Russian bands were playing. It was a big Volksfest character on whole Crimea. These were for the Russians, but as well as the other people who were not so dedicated pro-Russian. For them, it was a very logical decision to vote for Russia and not for Kiev or for independence.
And I guess you can talk about some of the groups that are opposed to Russia. So, what is your opinion of the right sector? Because they, on one hand, they claim to be nationalists, but they're actually aligning themselves with globalist interests, even though they claim to be nationalist.
Well, I think when it comes to the right sector, we should eventually stop talking about a political party, political movement, or maybe even an activist movement. Because when we see the politics of right sector, when we see the political aims, and also when we see where are the activists out of which movements where they are coming from, we have to say that this movement is a sort of NATO proxy, a Western proxy, and it's a proxy of international terrorism. We know in the meanwhile that many functionaries of the right sector were fighting in the Chechenian wars alongside the Chechenian terrorists against Russia. We know they were even helping Georgia in the Russian-Georgian war in 2008. And when we see today the pictures of the Maidan and we see the so-called Syrian revolutionary flag, which is nothing else than the colonial flag before Syria became completely independent, beside the flag of the right sector waving, it is more than just a symbol. We see there are close connections to those movements. So, can a movement with such ties as a Western proxy movement, can this be a nationalist as they claim? I think they can't. I think this is a sort of mask they wear because it might be positive. It might be considered as positive by the Ukrainian population right now. But in reality, they are nothing else than a CIA proxy or a NATO proxy. And when we see the presidential program of the presidential candidate, Dmitry Yarosh, the leader of the right sector, he says very clear he wants a Ukraine with very close ties to USA and to Great Britain, to UK. He says he wants military help from them. He dreams about an association with NATO as well as with the European Union. No nationalist movement, no patriotic European movement never ever would have such aims. But in Ukraine are the things a little bit different. So we should see that like this, and it's a little bit a shame that we see that on the one side, many patriots, real patriots, are going into this right sector trap by supporting them. And on the other side, we should be aware, why do European governments, for example, like the German government, who persecute any patriotic little movement in their own country, who defame everybody as a neo-Nazi who simply says, I want to be proud to be a German and I love my country. The same governments who persecute any patriotic or national conservative movement inside the country are supporting the most horrible, violent, hooliganist movements in a foreign country. I think we should be very aware what is going on. And of course, when the so-called revolution in Ukraine is finished, we can expect that the people of the right sector will be the first victims of that revolution. I think they will be the ones who will end up there in prison, except those who will then run for the next revolution in the next country, maybe in Belarus.
Yeah, because, I mean, those groups, I mean, nationalists obviously are not going to take power, but they're being kind of used as a proxy. Are there some Ukrainian nationalists who are opposed to the right sector, or you think most of them support it?
Well, the point is, when we talk about Ukrainian nationalism, it's already very hard to talk about this, because we have this Western Ukrainian culture and entity, where, of course, also the nationalists, so this is how it seems to me, they are very close, for example, to the Polish nationalism, and this is a very pro-Westernized, pro-European, pro-NATO influenced nationalism, what we see here. But we see on the east side and on the southern side, where we have the majority of the Russian population, the so-called separatists, what we have now in mainstream media, they call these people separatists and even terrorists, who are nothing else than federalists, who want to have their self-determination as the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. And I would consider these people as the real patriots. And by the way, when I was on Crimea, I think I met there people, patriots, Crimean patriots, Russian patriots, who are very close to things I believe in and things I'm convinced things any European patriot would believe in. And what is the most maybe sexy characteristic of nationalism, this is the will of sovereignty and the will of independence. So when it comes to this Western Ukrainian nationalism, we should always ask, why, for God's sake, do you want to sell your sovereignty and your independence to Brussels, to the European Union, to Washington, to NATO? As long as these questions are not answered, we should be very, very skeptical towards any movement considering itself as nationalist and Western Ukrainian, or even also what we witness in Poland, for example.
And I know there was an article posted on the alternative right saying, it was by Andy Nowicki, where he was saying that he was making the argument that Ukraine should be independent from either Russia or the West. Do you respect that argument, or do you think that they have to choose either Russia or the West, or do you think that's a valid argument that Ukraine can be totally independent?
Look, Robert, when you ask me if I respect an opinion, of course I do. I respect also the Eskimos telling me that he wants to have palms growing in the Arctic region. Of course I respect this, but we should go to the realities. The reality says there is no third position. There is no third position in this fight now we are, in this geopolitical war we are witnessing. And anybody who claims to have a third position is either a liar, he is taking advantage of those who believe that, or he is completely naive. Even this we cannot claim about the Eskimo calling for palms in the Arctic region, because we would say, well, maybe he's an idiot. So, but of course, the wish we have to respect, but the realities are as they are. And we have to say right now that those in Ukraine who claim they want to establish a Ukraine which is neither part of the West nor of the East are either naive or they are liars. And when we see that, what I was telling already, that Dmitry Yarosh is very clear in his stance towards the West, that he wants to connect Ukraine very much to the West and to the NATO, then we have to say these people are liars. They take advantage of naivety, of the hopes, maybe also of the stupidity of some activists. And it's the same thing anywhere. If we go to Chechnya, where the Islamists were saying, yes, they want to establish a sort of Caucasian emirate, we have to see that this Caucasian emirate at the end is nothing else than a Western proxy. The same for Georgia. Georgia is never fighting for its independence. Georgia is a state which is very associated with NATO, with USA, and with the European Union. In Syria, the jihadis who are fighting there, they say they are fighting for an emirate or something like that, or a Salafi state, we don't know what. But at the end, it is clear they are nothing else than the mercenaries of the West. They are either stupid or they are liars. This is the same choice for the Ukrainians.
And I know you posted, I saw that map you posted on Facebook. It shows this redrawing of the map where you depict Serbia as controlling the Balkans and Greece controlling Turkey, and I think Syria controlling the Middle East, and I think Armenia becoming like Eastern Turkey or something like that. Can you explain what that's about?
Yes. Oh, now you caught me with revisionist borderline.
Yeah.
New one. Of course, this was an ironical statement. I have to say this now, not that people think I will go now and change the borders. But of course, in every joke, in every ironical remark, there is a little true core. We have to see who are the powers of stability, who are the powers who serve anti-terrorist, anti-Western influence, what comes by coincidence always together, by the way, Western influence and terrorist movements. So which are the powers who serve that, and which are the powers who are fighting this? So let us look to the region. I recently was in Kosovo. Kosovo is nothing else than a failed state, a black hole in the center of Europe, built by criminals and built by the terrorist movement of UCK. It's a sort of Albanian state. So we have the Albanian...
Is that the Kosovo Liberation Army?
Yes, the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army, the UCK, which was dealing as the infantry of NATO in the war of 1999. So we have there those states who are always serving the West, and Albania, of course, is one of those states. Bosnia, of course, is one of those states. Unfortunately, Croatia is one of those states. Turkey is one of those states. So this map I was sharing on Facebook was an ironical remark how this region would look like if those states who serve as satellites, as violent satellites of NATO and of the West, wouldn't exist. And if, let me say it like this, more or less more responsible states like Syria, like Armenia, like Greece, like Serbia would take care of those societies who are more or less affiliated to the West.
So, and what is it? Can you explain the significance of those countries, Serbia, Greece, and Armenia?
Sorry?
Can you explain the significance of those countries you mentioned, Serbia, Greece, and Armenia?
Well, these are all states at the first. They have a very strong national identity. These are all states who suffered very much under Ottoman occupation. This is, by the way, the same for Syria itself, and also for Lebanon, for example. So these states learned within centuries how to serve and how to save your national culture. And the national culture just doesn't simply mean the language, the form of writing or other cultural elements. It also means the sort of their certain religion. These are also Orthodox states, for example. So these states managed under Ottoman occupation not just to save their national identity, they even developed it much more. They became stronger. The societies became stronger. And they have all these three examples we mentioned have a very, very strong and, in my opinion, a very positive skepticism towards the West. And when we see that Washington is the closest friend of the former, let me say, massive enemy of all these three societies, Turkey, then it's not a coincidence that we should have a lot of hope on the development of these three states in the region, and not, for example, on Turkey itself under Erdogan, or Albania, or Saudi Arabia, or whoever. So maybe the true core in this joke I was posting on Facebook is that these are three states we can put a lot of hope and a lot of expectations in.
And you mentioned Turkey. It was interesting, as I was actually kind of a surprise, because I know Dugan has actually called for an alliance. Has he called for an alliance with Turkey, which seems a little bit different from what you're saying.
He didn't call for an alliance with Erdogan. I think the problem of Turkey is very simple. The problem of Turkey is that the Turkish government, and not just right now, but since a longer time, is built by the AKP party. And the AKP party is a complete Western NATO proxy and nothing else. We had a couple of weeks ago the elections, and we saw that the Turkish people are electing that AKP. What Professor Dugin was calling on was to get close to those forces in the Turkish society which are positive towards our thinking. For example, the Turkish Workers' Party, where I think Dugin is very befriended with, and these are very positive forces, but they are so much away to have any influence and to have any power. What we see right now is the complete contradiction. We see Turkey as the number one warmongering state in the region. It is, in my opinion, the most dangerous NATO ally we can have, because Turkey nonstop tries to get into the war in Syria. And what this would mean, we have the paragraph number 5 in the NATO contract, which means also Germany as a NATO country would have to support Turkey in case of war. Turkey desperately tries to get into war with Syria. Germany has right now troops at the Turkish-Syrian border, as well as Netherlands and other NATO countries. So we see now with the realities, and this is what I'm now talking about, the recent realities of the Turkish state, we don't see any point where we could get close to that state and to that government. And when I think Professor Dugin is talking about Turkey, he means the perspective of development, what this country has. And this, I see the same thing, but what I see right now is not at all encouraging. It's the contradiction. We see that those forces Professor Dugin is supporting in Turkey are imprisoned. These people are persecuted. Everybody who is a rationist and not transatlanticist has a very, very difficult situation to stand in Turkey. And as long the situation is like that, Turkey is nothing else than, in a geopolitical sense, an enemy.
So is he talking, he's talking about a Turkish nationalist?
Sorry?
He's talking about a Turkish nationalist.
Well, when we look at the Turkish at the Turkish Workers' Party, they have on the one side, a very nationalistic agenda, but they have as well a Eurasianist agenda. We have also the nationalists, for example, of the MHP, which are on one side very pro-Westernized as well, who look for... I think it is not about if you are nationalist or not, if you're communist or not, you can be Bolshevik. I think you can be even a sort of liberal. It depends which side of the front line, of the geopolitical front line you take. So the Turkish Workers' Party says very clear that they don't want to be part of the NATO empire, of the Western imperialistic agenda in that region. And I think this makes exactly those parties and those groups dangerous for the general government agenda of the AKP government in Turkey. And it's not about nationalism, it's not about ideology, it's really about which side I take in that geopolitical fight.
So you're kind of saying what Professor Dugin is saying. It's a conflict between, you're saying, Eurasianism versus Atlanticism.
Well, when we go down, when we maybe, if you would ask the people right now fighting in Turkey and debating those things, maybe they didn't hear about both terms. But when we go down on the ground of both arguments, of both ideologies, it is always the question: is it a sovereignist agenda Turkey has? Is it agenda which is close to their identity, or is it an agenda where Turkey itself defines itself as a sort of barking dog of the West? When we see what Erdogan is doing now, Erdogan, by the way, he's leading his country not like a prime minister or a head of government. He's leading his country more or less like a gang leader. As I know it from Berlin, when we look in those quarters where we have a Turkish majority, we have so-called Turkish youth gangs. And Erdogan is very more close to a gang leader than he is to a statesman, because he bows extremely to those he considers as more dominant than himself, especially the United States, but also the European Union. And he steps down, he is beating those he considers as less powerful as himself. So this is, I think, the major problem of Turkey, that this country didn't find until now its own stand in the region, what they want to be. Until now, they have a neo-Ottoman agenda, which is based, we have to say, on a sort of national minority complex. maybe since the total breakdown of the Ottoman government, of the Ottoman Empire, that they want to be something big again. But they know they cannot reach it themselves. They don't have the power to do this themselves. They need a strong ally. By the way, as they needed at the end of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Empire just existed because of the help of UK, of France, and even of Berlin, of Germany. So we have the same situation right now. The Turkish neo-Ottoman program can't just exist because of the great support that they have, in that case now, from the NATO.
And last time I interviewed you, we talked about the situation in Syria. Syria hasn't been as big in the news as it was back then, but what is going on in Syria right now? I know the conflict is still occurring.
Well, the Syrian army is reporting about a lot of decisive progresses they do on the battlefield. But what we shouldn't forget is at the same time, for every jihadi who is killed, for every mercenary who is killed, two new are right now crossing the border. The Syrian army is fighting a very good, but at the same time, a very desperate fight against those who come into the country to bring trouble and to bring war. We have to assume right now that in the third year of the war, it is now waging in 3 years, maybe already one third or even more of the country is completely destroyed. It will take decades for Syria, in case of peace, by the way, to get back to the situation, to the economic situation, and also to the society situation they had before the war. And there is no big change. The Syrian army is doing progress, but at the same time, the jihadis are infiltrating the country. And here we have to say again, it's the decisive role of Turkey. If Turkey would get under a good government, a government which is has a sort of responsibility for the security in the region, the first step this government would do would be to close the borders, to close the Turkish-Syrian borders, because via that border, most of the terrorists infiltrate the Syrian state and to ambush the Syrian army. And the second step would be to close all the camps, all the training camps for terrorists, which are located on the Turkish side of the Turkish-Syrian border. So these would be two important decisive steps, because in case the so-called rebels, which are no rebels, these are foreign fighters coming to Syria, in case they would lose the foreign support, the major foreign support is given by Turkey, because Turkey is geopolitically the neighbor of Syria, it would be maybe ending within weeks without that support, without supply. But we are very, very far from that situation right now. So I am not very optimistic. I know that there are a lot of pro-Syrian analysts who are saying this war will end this year or it will end next year, while I say this war will go on exactly as long as the so-called rebel forces will have foreign support. And as long as this will not end, the country will be destroyed every day a bit more.
And back to the situation in the Ukraine. What is the situation in the Ukraine right now? I know, isn't the Ukraine building up their troop presence on the Russian border?
Yes, there are the attempts. I was recently speaking with friends who are right now in Donetsk, in the Donetsk region. What we witness right now is very interesting, because we can see a lot of parallels to Syria. We even see the so-called Western doublespeak, the double standards, when in eastern Ukraine, when people take over the authorities, the Russian people take over the authorities in eastern Ukraine and they call for a federalization, they don't do that because they are anti-Kiev or they hate Western Ukrainians. They do that for their own security, because they don't want to be governed by this weird mix of oligarchs and hooligans. But the West actually is supporting Kiev, is supporting this Putsch government, which is right now sending forces to eastern Ukraine to crack down those protests. And the most ironic thing is that this operation is called an anti-terrorist operation, while those people who are uprising in the east and in the south of Ukraine are called terrorists. The reality is right the other way. The reality is that those people who were occupying their authorities are doing this for their safety. They don't have any aggressive agenda. They do this for their self-protection, while those who are coming now from Kiev into those regions to fight there, these are the same forces which are commanded by the same people who command the terrorist forces, for example, in Syria as well as in Chechnya, or we were talking about Georgia as well. So we have this mix of terminology in those matters. What we witness right now is that a lot of Ukrainian army members, that the Ukrainian army itself is in a desolate constitution, that a lot of soldiers who are Russian speaking are going or are defecting. They are going to those who want to save eastern and southern Ukraine from the Kiev influence. So it will be a very, very interesting situation with a lot of provocations, especially against Russia, because the putsch government of Kiev has the certain aim to provoke Vladimir Putin and the Russian army to intervene in eastern Russia, because they got decisive promises from the West, especially from the NATO states, as well as from the European Union, of military support. And this is what they want. So it is now all about who is patient, who lets himself provoke by what is going on, and every day can bring something new. The most interesting thing is that the right sector we were talking about seems to be more or less a sort of insurgent army commanded by Kiev, also brought to eastern and southern Ukraine. And when we talk about such militias like the right sector, we have really to take a look to Syria, because those militias, they fulfill a very interesting mission in those conflicts. These militias don't order themselves to any law of war. They are very brutal. They do what they want. And in case they are doing crimes against humanity, or in case they do a lot of brutality against civilians, the central government, in that case Kiev, can always claim, we don't know these people, they are on their own there, we don't have any responsibility, what is going on. So this is also an interesting element of this warfare which is now going on, and right now it looks at least like that the regular army is not motivated at all to shoot at their own people in eastern and southern Ukraine, while the militias like right sector might become in future the decisive violent groups in that war.
What is the significance that Germany plays in this situation?
Germany plays a couple of roles in the situation. What is, in my opinion, it's not very lucky for us to be in that situation. So we are on the one side Europe's main economic power. We are the backbone, the economic backbone of Europe. What means that any support for Western Ukraine, for this failed state, for this black hole in Eastern Europe, which is now governed by a criminal gang, can just exist by German taxpayers' money in long scale. So Germany will turn out at the first thing as the financer of this government. The second important thing is that Germany is at the same time the most important trading and economic partner of Russia in Europe, what means that our economical relations are much, much better and much more friendly than our political relations. We see this, by the way, where now the West is calling generally for economic sanctions against Russia, that even our Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is a pure Atlanticist, but she's clever enough to see that this might harm our own industry, that she tries right now to balance a little bit because she's afraid of the economic consequences of such sanctions. We play a role as a NATO power. Germany is the aircraft carrier, the biggest aircraft carrier of the US Army and especially of the NATO in Germany right now are between 40,000 and 50,000 US American soldiers as occupation forces. We are not talking about this anymore, but these soldiers are permanent in our country and they can be permanently deployed to any conflict. We have the big airfields, we have the big US American military hospitals. We are, if you want to see it like that, the biggest US American military compound outside the United States. So this is also a role Germany plays. So you see in the spider web of geopolitical interests and aspects, Germany is playing a very problematic role, and we are playing this problematic role because we don't have a government which has the guts to stand up and to say it is not our business what is going on in Ukraine. We want to stay outside that conflict and we want to become a sovereign state. Dear US American friends, please leave our country as quick as possible.
And what do you see as like the worst case scenario? Could a full-blown war break out?
When we see how the politicians and how the mainstream media is reporting, we should be realistic. We see a sort of a pretext, a war pretext. When we look at wars which took place in the past, I say just for example the Libyan war, but also the war against Yugoslavia in 1999, the NATO war, the war against Afghanistan, the war against Iraq. This is the typical pretext now against the war. The only luck we have is that the war enemy this time is not a proxy. It's the evil, or the so-called evil in Western eyes itself, it's Russia. So it's not so easy simply to go on war against Russia. But the danger is realistic, and we should be aware of that danger, that we might have to go on war against Russia. And this would be a huge disaster, of course, for Europe, because it would mean that all the NATO armies would have to march against Russia. And in my opinion, this is a war where neither the Europeans, the real Europeans, I'm not speaking about the politicians, neither the Europeans nor the Russians have any interest in.
Before I wrap up the show, is there anything else about this you'd like to add?
I think it's it's always the dangerous question. No, I think everything is said, and I think for everybody we should really read very intense what we see now about war propaganda, and we should not believe simply everything we should read. I know it's easy said, but as I said, when I arrived on Crimea, I had the impression of a Russian tank army invading this little country, and it was not true. We have to get along with the imagination that many things we read in Western mainstream media don't have even anymore the true core, that there is even not anymore any true core about those news. So we should be more careful in believing what we read than we were before.
Well, Manuel Uchsenreiter, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Thank you.